Good morning, everyone. We are continuing with the series on the Holy Name of God, and I'm going to begin with the same story that you've heard over and over and over again. Forgive me if you're sick of it by now, but it's a whole series of talks on this topic is based on something that I heard from one of our Swamis when I was in Tribhuco. He was an Englishman, Swami Vajrananda, and he was a great tea lover. And he used to say that in England, we drink tea at three different times: when it's very hot out, when it's very cold out, and any other time. Okay, good. So it still gets a laugh. It's a good story. The reason why I keep telling this is that I've really divided this topic into three different sections. One is what we can call traditional japa, when we are either repeating the name of God, we may say it out loud. If we say it silently, we may even move our lips. So the tongue is lips and sound, vocal cords and everything may be involved in the whole thing. This is one. And we may do it at times when we're feeling a little bit disturbed. We want to get cooled down. Say, if we're feeling a little bit under the sway of the passions, anger, greed, envy, jealousy, any of these things, we may repeat the mantra and it'll cool us down a little bit. Then, at the time of meditation, when we want to do some tapasya, we want to get that heat, we want to really go deep within, we can repeat the mantra silently with the feeling that there's no connection to the tongue or the mouth or vocal cords or anything, that it's kind of springing up deep within. And when we're feeling a little bit tepid and lukewarm and everything, this will heat us up. So this is the second time. So first is a japa when we're keeping track, count. We may be using our hands and a mala and everything. We may be using the lips, something like that. And the other is meditation, when we're going deep within. We're trying to forget that we even have a physical body. So the first one will be purifying everything, going outward. The second one, going deep within. The third, at any other time, means at every other time. So this will be connected with karma yoga. This will be connected with the practice of repeating the mantra with every breath, if possible, during every waking hour, and even with the idea that it'll be going on while we're asleep on its own, so that the mantra takes on a life of its own, that there's no effort involved. We try to reach that point where it'll be spontaneously going on over and over and over again, ceaselessly. So we discussed earlier the first use of the mantra, the japa, where we're keeping track and keeping count, a particular number. Then last week we went through meditation, and this week we'll go through really this idea of using, utilizing the mantra and japa as an aid to help us in karma yoga. And karma yoga, we'll see, will include everything. It'll help with our devotional attitude, with our surrender, with our concentration, with everything. So this will be the topic today. This attempt to repeat the mantra ceaselessly at all times without any gap. And this is really what we mean by becoming perfected in japa, japa siddha. Those who practice this type of spiritual discipline reach a point where this mantra will be going on. They won't even feel that they're the ones who are doing it. Rather than being the one repeating the mantra, will become the one who's listening or hearing the mantra. A little shift takes place that way. And once we've reached that stage, then we know we've entered into a little higher level, this spontaneous level. Not that we've reached this raga bhakti stage or anything like that, but at least it is kind of a turning point. So we'll see that this can be done. There are people who do it. It takes a little effort in the beginning, but it becomes a natural type of thing, so that we even feel that we fall asleep at night repeating the mantra, and as soon as we wake up, we'll hear it. It'll almost wake us up. And we'll have the distinct feeling that it's been going on throughout the night and working its magic even while we're asleep. So this is that practice of what's called ajapa japa. This is a very interesting term and a very interesting concept. Japa, it comes from a Sanskrit word that means really to kind of mumble something. If other people don't know what's going on, they'll hear us repeating something softly over and over again. They won't know what it is, but it has this sense of something that's done, if not audibly, so that other people know what we're doing, but it'll sound like we're mumbling a little bit. So this ajapa means that there's no audible sound. So it means that, number one, that it's soundless. Ajapa japa. So it's just something that we feel is springing up from the depths of our being. It's not something that we're repeating with the tongue or anything. It has this kind of eternal, absolute nature to it. We have this concept with the sound of Om. It's called the Anahata Dhvani. Anahata means that it's unstruck. Every sound that we hear has three components to it. We learned this when we were in school, right? There has to be something that causes the vibration to go. There has to be a medium, and there has to be something that can hear it. So if we strike something, then the air will carry that vibration, and it'll hit the eardrum, and it'll strike the eardrum the same way with the same type of vibration, so that we'll hear it as we think that the sound actually is. So we need these three things. Every sound has to be the result of these three things. That's why, you know, they have that riddle: if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, is there any sound? Does it make any sound? We can say if we stick to this strictly, there won't be any sound unless there's someone there to hear it. Now, this anahata dhvani is supposed to be the only sound that is not the result of any vibration. Why? Because this Om is the original sound identified with the Brahman before there's any physical creation even. So it's the source of everything. So it has to be the one thing that's not the result of the need for an eardrum and the need for this air to carry the vibration, or for anything that's struck. So we have the similar idea, or feeling at least, with the mantra, that it's going on, it's being repeated somehow out of this infinite akasha, this infinite divine space, that is not the result of our own effort or not the result of any vocalization or anything like that. So this is the first aspect to this, japa japa, that it's soundless. Then the second is that it's spontaneous, that there's no effort involved, and we don't feel that we're the ones who are doing it. If I feel that I'm the one who's doing it, that means that I have to keep reminding myself and keep trying to do it, and as soon as I stop reminding myself, then I forget. Those who practice this and become perfected in this, japa japa, they don't make any effort. They reach the stage where it goes on as if by itself, as if a loop, a tape with a loop, it just goes on over and over again. And this brings us to the third one, that it's ceaseless. So we're not making any effort to do it, but it's going on over and over and over again. So we have the three S's: soundless, spontaneous, and ceaseless. Was the third one is a C. Yeah. But the three S sounds, if you want to remember it that way. And one of the examples that's very often given of this ajapa japa is what's called the Hamsa mantra. Hamsa means a swan. And the Paramahamsa, so it comes to mean the soul. But if we repeat hamsa, there's a santi change that takes place. It becomes hamso, hamso, hamso. So if we keep repeating that, hamso, 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 ham, it becomes soham. And those who practice this, in conjunction with the ingoing breath and the outgoing breath, reach the stage where they won't be able to breathe in or breathe out without going soham, soham, silently, of course, without effort, so that they'll be hearing it. So, of course, we can do it with any mantra, but this is one that's very often mentioned as part of this japa japa, this soham, soham, soham. And it is soundless, and it is spontaneous, and it is ceaseless. So this is the goal for those who practice this. Now, not everyone will do this. There are some who will, of course, focus on the mantra and japa and everything, but at other times they'll listen to devotional music or do other things. There are some people who will try not to do anything else. I remember when I first took initiation many years ago, I couldn't bear to have anything on, to hear if someone would turn on the radio or there was people were talking and everything, because it seemed to interfere. I was trying to get established in that. And now I'm not such a fanatic. But there are some people who this becomes a very important part of their spiritual practice, and you'll see that they remain silent, and you can almost tell that they're listening to the mantra the whole time. And we'll see later this morning how important that is, and how that becomes a constant reminder to us that if we're not paying attention, it'll be tapping us on the shoulder. Listen to me. And the mantra will be identified then with our Ishta Devata, saying, don't forget me, remember me. So it becomes a very, very important type of practice. So what we're really focusing on this morning is how this repetition of the divine name, or this mantra, or this constant flow of japa can help us, using the discipline of karma yoga. We can say that earlier with the meditation, we did our raja yoga. With the japa, we did our bhakti yoga. And both of them involved a spiritual attitude. We had our jnana yoga. So this morning, there'll be more concentration on karma yoga, how this repetition of the name of God can function as a very, very important aid in the practice of karma yoga. So I want to start with just some very basic ideas about what we mean by karma yoga. We have divided the yogas into four main yogas. It's a little bit arbitrary. And in Gita, we have the 18 chapters. Each one is called a yoga. We could combine some of them. We could come up with more of them. But this is what we have, the very common designation. And, of course, Swami Vivekananda made it very popular because he published four different books under the names of each of the four types of yoga. But they're not exactly parallel. And they don't always occur separately. If someone is a jnana yogi, that doesn't mean they won't practice meditation. The same thing with someone is a bhakta. It doesn't mean they won't practice karma yoga. So they mix and match. Some of them work better together than others. It depends on our personality. Sometimes we do one in combination with another. Sometimes we do one following another. So we have all of these. But this karma yoga is a little bit different because it has to be utilized in order to practice all of the others, because karma means action. If we want to put any of the others into practice, then we're doing our karma yoga. And conversely, if we want to practice karma yoga, we need to have some type of spiritual attitude and understanding. So we need a little bit of jnana yoga. It can be done either from a devotional point of view, where we do everything as an offering to God, so we need to bring in some bhakti yoga. It can be this, as I say, either a jnani point of view, where we also want to practice meditation. And one of the most important elements is concentration. So we need our Raja Yoga, we need our meditation. So we'll see that Karma Yoga is always looking for help. We need to incorporate a little bit of devotion, a little bit of knowledge, a little bit of meditation, and depending on our spiritual attitude, more or less of one or the other. So we'll see that this, what we call Karma Yoga, involves a harmony between itself and one or more of the other yogas. So philosophical attitude, devotional attitude, and concentration. So there we get our Jnana Yoga, we get our Bhakti Yoga, and our Raja Yoga. The basic concept of Karma Yoga, is quite simple. We've heard these things so many times that we perform an action, or we think a thought, we do anything, and it leaves a mark, it leaves some type of karmic effect on the mind. And if we repeat that, it becomes a habit, it becomes a samskara. And if we repeat it often enough, it becomes a deep samskara. And we find that in the future, we react in the same way, and we think in the same way, and we have the same tendencies to do things. This is all the result of karma, of action. So now we're really in this theory of karma. When we get to Karma Yoga, we want to try to put an end to this, because this represents a type of bondage for us. Now, we may say that, well, what if we keep doing good things and we get the good samskaras? This is true. This is very helpful, because this will eliminate the bad samskaras. But any action that's done with a sense of agency, with a sense of I, any action that's done with the feeling that I'm the doer of the action and I'm responsible for the results and the fruits of action, anything we do with attachment will leave a mark, and which will represent a type of bondage for us. Now, the tamasic and rajasic bondage are very harmful. A sattvic type of bondage is still a bondage. This is what Swamiji says, a chain of gold can bind us just as much as a chain of iron. But the sattva is what we use to overcome tamas and rajas. So in the beginning, we want this. We don't mind having this chain of gold, because it's going to replace the other one. Then we go beyond that. So what we're really trying to do is perform action in such a way that it doesn't add to our store of karma. That means we have different options. Either we eliminate the sense of agency, or we eliminate attachment to the fruits of action, or we perform action as an offering. Any of these ways, this will allow us not to accumulate more karma, number one, and number two, to start exhausting our old karma. So these two things happen. We have a whole bag full that we're carrying around. We think, how do we get rid of it? Well, we're doing two things at the same time. Not only are we not adding to it, but automatically it has to get lighter and lighter and lighter, because this is the nature of karma. So what we're trying to do here is eliminate this sense of I through some technique that we use, some attitude that we use while we're performing action. Because whenever we do something, we have the feeling, I'm the one doing it. I am the bhokta, I am the karta. These two represent ignorance. I am the enjoyer of action, and I am the doer of action. So this is what Sri Ramakrishna says, is that stick of ego, that feeling of agency that lies on the surface of the water, that gives the impression of separation, so that we feel restricted and limited and different from other people and separate from God. So even if it's a very fine stick, sattvic stick, if it gives us that sense of separation, then we have to transcend it. So this is the goal of Karma Yoga, that we perform action without the feeling of I-ness, I and mind. We try to eliminate that. We do it as an offering to God. We do it without any attachment to the fruits. We do it with great love and care and devotion and concentration. And then the karmic effect of action won't touch us. Nalipyate. We have all of these beautiful examples in the Gita and other texts, that just as you throw water on a lotus leaf, it'll ball up like a piece of, like mercury almost, and roll right off. It won't stick to it at all. So the karma, it'll just roll off. We won't be affected by it. None of it will take hold on us. So this is what we're trying to do when we practice karma yoga. And as I say, it depends on our spiritual attitude, because there are different ways that we can perform it, depending on whether we're more devotional or more philosophical or meditative. We have these three other yogas that we will incorporate into our karma yoga. So we have the devotional attitude, where everything we do as an offering. Now, this means that I do have a sense of I admit it. Someone will say, well, this sense of I is false. I'll say, good. Okay, you can say that it's false, very good for you, but I feel like I'm doing it. You can tell me I'm not doing it, I'll think you're a madman. I feel that I'm doing it, so let me at least think I'll do it as an offering. Sri Ramakrishna says, if this I, sense of I remains, then let it remain, but let it be the servant of God, child of God, have a relationship with God, do everything as an offering. Just as the servant will not do anything for his or her own sake, but only for the sake of the master. The whole mind will be in the master. Will the master be pleased? This is the way we have to perform action with this devotional attitude. Now, there are other devotional attitudes also. We may feel that I'm simply an instrument, that God dwells within, the Divine Mother. She's the one doing everything. I'm just a plaything in her hands. A different type of devotional attitude. So this one doesn't involve so much the idea that I'll do everything as an offering, but this idea that Mother is doing everything. This also eliminates the karmic effect of action. Then if we're very philosophical, we can also feel that we're not the agent of action from this kind of Sankhya point of view, we can say. And we find this in Gita also. We analyze action, we find that what is acting? The hands are performing action. We see something, takes a message to the mind. The mind gives it to the buddhi. Buddhi makes a decision, sends it back to the mind, goes through the hands, and we do something. I'm the witness. I'm not involved. I simply watch the whole thing. If I'm identified with this witness and not with this mind-body complex that is performing the action, then there's also no karmic effect to any of that. So whatever our particular attitude is, either I am the doer, but everything is an offering to God, or God alone is the real agent, or it's just this play of the gunas that everything is getting done and I'm the witness. All of these are different ways of saving us from this karmic effect, and all of them require certain elements, certain things to be performed. That is, we have to have equanimity of mind, we have to have non-attachment to the fruits, we have to have great concentration. If we do anything as an offering, then we can't do anything in a sloppy fashion. We have to use great concentration, great devotion, great love. This is why in Gita, again, we have such emphasis on performing things skillfully. Yoga, one of the definitions of yoga is karmasu kosalam, that we perform all of our actions with dexterity, with concentration, with skillfulness. We do it nicely and carefully. If someone that we have great respect for comes into our house, we want to make sure it's nice and neat and clean. If we cook something, the presentation should be nice, the food should be good. It has to be done with great concentration and with great care. So this is the role of Raja Yoga, because in Raja Yoga, we're trying to develop this sense of concentration. This isn't the main aid in meditation. Really, what we do is not meditation at all. It's attempted concentration. This concentration will deepen into meditation, but when we do this Abhyasa Yoga, the mind is wandering, we bring it back. We're trying to concentrate the mind, to fix the mind. This is what we can say one of the earlier stages of meditation. But regardless of our spiritual attitude, regardless of the mood that we have, how we think of ourselves, that I am a servant of God or I am simply the witness, regardless of that, we'll find that one of the greatest aids in all of these different ways of practicing karma yoga is this repetition of the mantra throughout the day. And it'll help us in different ways depending upon our spiritual attitude. If we can do it with every breath, then we'll find that it's helpful with our concentration, it's helpful to remind us to be detached, to do everything as an offering. It's helpful in every possible way. It sounds difficult, but like anything else, it's a habit that we form. If we do it often enough, especially in the beginning of spiritual life, we find that it becomes habitual with us, second nature. It becomes part of our very being. If for a second the mind is kind of empty, we'll think, oh, what happened? It should be filled with the mantra. As soon as the mind is quiet, the mantra should be going on. And then after a while, it reaches that level of spontaneity. And as I said before, we skip to a different tier, a different level at that time. This is a great turning point. So constant repetition of the mantra is also the way we practice constant recollection. We very often hear that. Sri Ramakrishna emphasizes this very much. Sometimes the devotees will say that, oh, I can't meditate, the mind wanders. And they'll say, then practice this constant recollection. Smaran manan, he uses this expression. Shoran manan in Bengali, let the mind dwell. It doesn't have to be so deeply concentrated. It doesn't have to be at the time of meditation with the eyes closed throughout the day. Let the mind dwell on whatever a spiritual attitude that you have. If you like to think of God as a personal God, then think of the divine play. Think of the lila. If you're more meditative, then throughout the day, remember the presence of the divine within the heart as the higher self, whatever it is. So this constant recollection, one of the best ways to do it is to repeat this mantra, because it's very hard to constantly be thinking one thought or a series of thoughts. But to repeat a phrase, to repeat this mantra, we can do it. It can be something that we train the mind to do. There are times throughout the day we know when it's impossible. We're speaking to other people, the phone rings, somebody comes to the door. It depends on the type of work that we do. Actually, those people who do physical work, rather than something that requires reading and writing and doing figures, anything like that. People who do physical work can practice this much better. And I think that this is why in so many monastic institutions throughout the world, the monks are encouraged to do some type of what looks like menial work. Drawing water from the well, sweeping, all of these things, because the mind can be wholly on God at that time. And at the same time, performing the task at hand. They're not mutually exclusive things. So the theory is that when the mind is not capable of repeating this mantra silently, because the mind, we have to be engaged with other people or other things, that it doesn't stop, it goes underground. It's continuing, it goes underground, and then as soon as we're finished, we finish the phone call, it comes back. We don't have to remember to bring it back. It comes back. And we get the feeling that it's going on the whole time. There's a beautiful statement that was made by Swami Turiyananda. He said, always repeat the name of God while taking meals, while at bed, or when you are at your seat doing spiritual practice. Yeah, at bed. Somebody said to me once that they feel funny repeating the mantra at night because they'll fall asleep. Of course we'll fall asleep, but the point is that we're falling asleep repeating the name of God. So this is the perfect time, because there's nothing else going on. And suppose we can't sleep, suppose we have insomnia, we're repeating the name of God. What a wonderful thing. It doesn't matter. We won't feel that anything is wasted at that time. So he says, while taking meals, while at bed, or when you are at your seat doing spiritual practice, just close your lips and be busy only with the repetition of the name of God. The master, meaning Sri Ramakrishna, would cite the example of the compass. The needle of a compass always points to the north. You may turn the needle away, but as soon as you let go the hold, it again points to the north. Your mind also should be so molded. If somebody comes and diverts your mind to any other topic, as soon as he leaves you, the mind should again be repeating his name. Just see, so long I was talking with you. As soon as I have stopped speaking, the song is going on within. He doesn't say, I begin repeating it again. The song is going on within. That's the spontaneous, ceaseless nature of japa. For those who become perfect in this japa. So we can feel that no effort is being made. It's going on all the time, even while we're sleeping. And we have to have the faith that this is like corrosive acid that's just eating through this ego that will have its effect. It's impossible that it won't have its effect. We have to have that faith, and that even while we're sleeping, if it's going on, we can even feel that when we wake up in the morning that we may catch it right in the middle. If we do that, then we'll really be convinced that it has been going on. And yes, we weren't conscious of it because we were asleep. We wake up, and at whatever stage that mantra that we're at, we'll hear it at that stage. So this mantra is always there. We have a type of psychology called gestalt psychology. And there's this theory of the figure and ground. Because sometimes we think that the mind can only do one thing at a time. But there's a very nice idea that we always have one object of focus, but there's always a background there. And we're always aware of that background, but it won't be the main object of focus. We see Sri Ramakrishna is seated there, and we can be focused on Sri Ramakrishna, but we're aware of that beautiful cloth behind him also. We can switch our focus and then look at the cloth, but we'll still be aware that Sri Ramakrishna is there. So the same thing with this mantra, that we want it to be the figure. We want it to be the object of our awareness as far as possible. But something else comes there, let it be the background. It won't disappear. Let it be the background there, and then as soon as we're finished with that, it comes right back. There's a story that we read more than once in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna about the great devotee Narada. And he doesn't speak about this in the context of japa, but I think it fits in very well. We know that there are lots of stories of Narada going back and forth between Vaikuntha, where he's good friends with Narayana, and the earth, and being a messenger, going back and forth, and sometimes mixing things up, and sometimes making a little fun and trouble about things. This is Narada, but he's considered to be a great devotee, great lover of God, such an intimate, close companion of Narayana. So one day, they were sitting together, Narada and Narayana, the Lord. And Narada asked him, who is your greatest devotee? And it was a loaded question, because he was fully expecting that Narayana would say, oh yes, Narada, you're my greatest devotee. Who else is greater than you? But maybe to curb his pride, maybe for some other reason, he said, you know, there's a little village in some area here. He could, from Vaikuntha, you can look down and see. So he pointed to that area, and he said, there's a farmer there, and this farmer's a great devotee. I would say he's probably my greatest devotee. So this Narada got a little proud. He said, how is it possible? Let me see who this fellow is and find out what the big deal is about him. So Narada goes, and he visits this farmer. And he sees that early morning, the farmer gets up. He has a little shrine. He goes there. He bows down before the image of the Lord in the shrine and says, O Lord, may everything that I do today be done as an offering to you. And then he leaves and he goes and he spends the whole day working in the field. Whether he's remembering God or not, we don't know. And then he comes back at the end of the day and he goes back to the shrine. He says, "Oh Lord, whatever I did, let it be an offering to you. If I was unable to remember you throughout the day, please forgive me." So this is it. Now, Narada saw all of this, and he wasn't impressed. He went back to Narayan and said, "Okay, what's the big deal about this guy? He remembers you twice a day. That's all. And the rest of the time, he's busy with his work." He comes back and he says, "Don't mind, I was so busy with work, I couldn't think of you the whole day. I tried and everything, but that's it." So then Narayana, as if changing the topic, he says, "Okay, I understand, but," he says, "do something for me." He said, "Take this cup," and he filled it with oil. So right to the very top, and he said, "I want you to walk around the earth. Bring this cup of oil back to me, and don't spill a single drop." So Narada took this as you know, the command of the Lord. With great concentration, he walked all around the world, came back, and said, "See, I didn't spill a single drop." So Narayana said, "Okay, very good. How many times did you remember me?" And he said, "Remember you. The whole mind was on the oil. How could I remember you? Whole mind was on the oil." And then Narayana said, "See, you didn't remember me even once. That farmer at least remembered me twice. Once at the beginning and once at the end." Now, what is the point of this story? There are a few things that we learn from this, some positive things and some negative things. Of course, part of it is to curb the pride of Narada, that we shouldn't think that we're such great devotees. There'll always be someone who's much more devoted than we are. Narada assumed that Narayan would praise him, and he was very disappointed that way. So this is one element of this, that we shouldn't have that type of pride. Then we're supposed to see the greatness of doing everything as an offering to God. Because at the end of the day, this farmer said, "Whatever I did, let that be an offering to you." In the beginning, he said, "Whatever I do, please, you'll accept that as an offering." And then at the end, he said, "Now, I've finished it, and everything is for you." But we also see that being so busy with work, it was impossible for him to remember God. Now, one of the keys of Karma Yoga is to remember God throughout the day. This is what I consider to be the weak point in this story. Right? The weak point in this story, and I would say that both Narada and the farmer were not up to the mark 100%. Right? Narada, of course, he didn't remember God at all. He had great pride, but he had great concentration. He did that part. So from that point of view, he was 100% successful. From the point of view of remembering God, he was a failure. And this is a little bit based on this idea that the mind is incapable of focusing on two things at the same time, and this is why I brought up that idea of figure and ground, that yes, we can't focus on two things at once. We talk about multitasking. Generally, multitasking means we're juggling. While one ball's in the air, we catch the other one, then we throw it in the air, we catch the other one, or we do something with more concentration, the other with a little bit less. This practice of remembrance of God and this practice of japa, because it becomes spontaneous and doesn't require effort, means that it can be going on at the same time that we're fully concentrated in something else. So this, I would say, is the kind of footnote to this whole story, that in reality, we want to do something that neither Narada or the farmer was able to do. We want to be able to have that 100% concentration and at the same time to have that full recollection, which means that the mantra can be going on at exactly the same time. And I have found personally in my own life that not only is it possible, but when we repeat the mantra, at times when we're doing something that requires very intense concentration, that it helps rather than hinders. Most of you know that I like to do woodworking. And there are all different tools and instruments in the shop. And this was something that I started when I first joined in Chabuco Canyon in California, that every day I would go and work in the shop. And generally, I was there all by myself. So this was my sanctuary. This was my temple. I had such a good time. And I felt that everything I was doing was an offering. And I also tried to, of course, be repeating the mantra. There was no one to bother me, to talk to or anything. I was working with my hands. Whatever calculations I had to do, there wasn't any distraction. So I would try to repeat the mantra the whole time. But I noticed that there were certain types of jobs that I had to do that required a special degree of concentration. And the one thing that I noticed especially, there's a tool called a bandsaw. Does anybody know what a bandsaw is? It's a very, very thin blade that allows you to cut curves. Most saws you can only cut straight. So if you have to make a curve in something, see all of the curves here? If you have to make a curve, first you'll take the wood and you'll draw these curves there. Then you'll take the wood and you have to manipulate the wood, keep turning it, so that the blade and the pencil mark never deviate. So I used to think of this as bandsaw yoga. This is, right? This is yoga. We're trying to keep them together the whole time without any gap or any separation. If I would lose concentration, then I would say, well, I went too deep into it or I missed it. I have to go back, sand. But if I was really deeply concentrated, then I would feel that nothing existed but the eye and the hands and the saw and the wood. And it would just go. But I found that if I repeated the mantra, that it would be very clear, crystal clear at that time, and would be a great help in my ability to concentrate. So it's the exact opposite. Sometimes we think we can only do one or the other. It helps. It makes it easier for us to concentrate the mind, because at other times we're not concentrated on anything. The mind wanders. It goes someplace else. We end up cutting our fingers off. So it's not because I was repeating the mantra that I had this accident. That actually reminds us to be concentrated on the work at hand. So this is a great, great lesson that we should never think that if we're concentrating on the mantra, that we won't be able to concentrate on our work, we'll have an accident, something. It actually helps us that way. I'll tell you one other nice experience that I had. When Swami Swanandi used to visit once a month, he would come to Chabuco, he would stay for a few days, and I used to take tea for him at 4 o'clock every afternoon when he got up from his nap. And before I became intelligent enough to figure out to put it in a flask and take it down there, I used to just put it in the teacup. And it's kind of a steep walk from the kitchen in Chabuco down to his room there. So I would very, very carefully, like Narada, I would have to carry it down there without spilling a single drop. But I always made a point to be repeating with great concentration and full awareness, to be repeating the mantra at the same time. And I found that it's perfectly possible and helpful. And it keeps the mind focused on the job at hand also. So we can do both of these things at the same time. So this is why I'm not impressed at all with Narada, and even the farmer, he could have done a little better. So this is the first lesson that we learn, that it is possible to remember God through the repetition of the mantra, even when we're doing work, very detailed work that requires great concentration, and I would say especially when we're doing that type of work, if it's basically working with the hands, some type of something that doesn't involve reading or talking or other types of things. Then the second lesson we learned from this story is that Narada was full of this idea of I and mine. I didn't spill a drop. We want to do this karma yoga. We have to get rid of this I and mine. That I am your best devotee, that I didn't spill a drop, that there's no one greater than me, all of this idea. So this is the second thing. And here also, repetition of the name of God, this mantra going on, is helpful in eliminating this idea of I and mine, because it brings us back down to the center. It takes the mind off of this egocentric self into that deeper type of self where we feel the divine presence within, because we're repeating the name of God. And that's the real essence of our being, not this ego sense. So this repetition of the mantra at all times is also reminding us that I am not the doer, I am not the enjoyer, it's that divine presence within, however we understand it. So this helps us go beyond, to see that reality behind the ego and the personality, because this mantra occupies the same space in the heart that the ego does. And we're repeating this mantra, there's no room for the ego. And when the ego's there, there's no room for the mantra. So the repetition of this mantra, we should feel, is kicking out this ego sense, this small lower self, and replacing it with that feeling of the divine within. Or, if not that much, at least that feeling that I'm doing all of this as an offering to God, I'm a servant of God, that type of idea. So this repetition of the mantra as we work also, so we have two things so far. One, it helps with concentration. The second is that it gets rid of the sense of I and mine. And the third is that it gives us the feeling of being the witness, because we're no longer feeling even that I'm repeating the mantra, I'm hearing the mantra. I am the witness of all of this. So this helps with his overall attitude of being the witness, this repetition of the mantra, because we lose the sense of agency with regard to being the repeater of the mantra. It just goes on. We feel no sense of agency with regard to the repetition of the mantra when we reach this stage of this japa-siddha type of stage. So we feel that we're the witness, we're the non-agent of action. And this is especially true when this mantra is going on ceaselessly, and with we experience it with great concentration. So we've seen so far that this repetition of the name of God is helping us in this karma yoga from the point of view of concentration, that's our raja yoga, and from the feeling of being the witness, the actionless witness, the jnana yoga part, and then bhakti yoga. If the ishta devata, the chosen ideal, chosen deity, is a personal aspect of God, and we feel that we're doing everything as an offering to God, then this is the greatest aid in that also, because of the constant reminder why we're doing what we're doing. We're doing it as an offering. The mantra is telling us, is reminding us that this is the whole purpose of everything that we do. We do everything simply as an offering to God dwelling within the heart. So this repetition of the of mantra, especially from the point of view of the personal God, is one of the easiest ways to maintain a devotional mood, devotional attitude. And it's going on. The Holy Mother gives the example of the clock. You know, there's these little noisy clocks that go tick, 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 that it'll never miss a tick. It'll just keep going over and over again. She used to say that we should try to repeat the name of God like that, and this name of God, personal, from a personal point of view, each time it goes another tick, it's another reminder why we're doing everything that we're doing, what's important in life, what's our goal in life. So from the devotional point of view, from the meditative point of view, from the point of view of knowledge, from a devotional point of view, this repetition, ceaseless repetition of the mantra is one of the greatest aids that we have. Now, our karma yoga takes another form also, and this is something that Swami Vivekananda emphasized. For him, the highest type of karma yoga was seeing God dwelling in other people, other beings, and serving them as a type of worship of God. So when we repeat the mantra, it shouldn't simply remind us of our own divine nature, it should remind us of the divinity of everyone. So if we see God dwelling within our own hearts, we have to see God dwelling within the hearts of all. And that means that our service to others will be, we'll do it with tremendous gratitude that we're allowed to worship God standing before us in human form. So the repetition of the mantra is also extremely helpful in that way. So all of this is this, the mantra is reminding us of these things. It's purifying our motive for action. It's allowing us to do everything as an offering, and it's allowing all of our work to be converted into worship, which was Swamiji's ideal, that our work should always be a type of worship, a type of offering. If our work involves service to others, then direct worship of God dwelling within other beings. So we'll find that this repetition of the mantra, it's not simply something that purifies the heart. Of course, all of these things take place, but it brings great joy and great peace to us. Anything that eliminates this sense of ego automatically brings peace. Because the second we start thinking of ourselves as very needy people, as very small, limited people, as people who need respect from other people, we lose our peace instantly. The mantra is telling us, no, this isn't your real nature. So this is the greatest aid, really, that we have. And when this mantra begins to take on a life of its own, as Swami Turiyananda said, that it's a song that's going on constantly, that we're hearing this song that's being sung, we find that it's as if our own chosen ideal were whispering to us throughout the day, reminding us, whispering to us, remember me, don't forget me. It's so easy to forget. This mantra is going on. Chosen ideal is saying, remember me, remember why you're doing what you're doing, for whose sake you're doing your work. Remember to do all of your work with great care, with great attention, with great devotion, with great love, with great skill. Remember to be detached from the fruits of the action, to remember to remain the witness throughout the day of everything you're doing. Remember to see me as the real agent and enjoyer of action. And remember to be selfless, to try to see me dwelling within all beings. This really is the meaning of the mantra. We are always told, meditate on the meaning of the mantra. This is the meaning of the mantra that God himself is telling us all of these things, reminding us. It becomes an effortless, spontaneous type of thing. And this is the real value of the mantra. With regard to karma yoga, now when we say with regard to karma yoga, we mean with regard to life, with regard to every waking moment that we have. This is how this constant repetition of the name of God can be our greatest help in spiritual life.